from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. You may notice a few unhappy hybrid drivers on the highways this morning. For the past 6 years, drivers of those cars have had a special privilege. They've been able to drive in the carpool lane, even if they're driving solo. But no more. As of today, hybrid drivers have to pull over and join the crowded lanes to the right. In our opening hour of Forum today, we'll talk about why the state is changing the rules, what it will mean for the Bay Area commute, and what it will mean for the future of electric cars. The future of the Bay Area commute and the future of electric cars are topics next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Rarely has a small yellow decal been so prized. That's the decal that gave 85,000 hybrid vehicle drivers the right to drive solo in the carpool lane. But today marks the end of the free ride. No more decal, no more get-out-of-jail-free card. As of this morning's commute, solo drivers of hybrid vehicles are just like everybody else, stuck in the slow lane. So why did the state change the rules? What will this mean for the Bay Area commute? And what will it mean for electric car sales, the cars that can still drive in the carpool lane? And if you're a hybrid driver, what are you going to do next? We're going to explore those questions this hour. Joining us first to do so is John Swanton. He's an air pollution specialist with the California Air Resources Board. Mr. Swanton, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
Happy to have you here. Why did the state choose to have this cutoff date today?
Well, the important thing to remember is it's not that something that they changed the rules midway. For these programs to exist where we're using excess capacity in carpool lanes, there has to be features of the program that make it valid for the future. In other words, there has to be a time limit on it so that if we are, in fact, incentivizing vehicles that are driving new technologies, when those vehicles are no longer the cutting edge of technology and they've been given a fair time for that incentive, they have to make room for a new generation of vehicles. And that's simply what's happening now. We still have a white sticker vehicle program, which is there for vehicles that are zero emissions and super clean alternative fuels, and that program is increasing in utilization.
And how okay. well did the hybrid part of this work? Did it do what you had hoped it to do in terms of people taking advantage of it?
Absolutely. Hybrids would probably not have the position in the marketplace without this factor. There were many things that did come into play as well. Fuel prices were one of them. But the fact that in California, where people are looking for any way to shorten their commute, this got consumers over any sort of trepidation they had on adopting a new technology. So without this, I think without doubt, we would not be in the same position. But on the other hand, vehicles without these stickers, as far as hybrids, are now in the majority. I mean, these vehicles that have the stickers, are not the greatest number of hybrids that are out there.
And so in terms of making the change now, one of the things you've heard about over the last couple of days as this story has gotten more attention is that it's because the carpool lane has gotten too crowded, that there are too many people driving Toyota Priuses clogging up the lane. That's not so much the case. It was really more a time to bring this part of the incentivizing effort to a close and open it up to newer forms of transportation.
Well, that is part of it. There is only a certain capacity that carpool lanes can have, and that capacity varies across the state depending on, again, utilization of the lanes. But in that, you can't have room for new generations of vehicles unless somebody goes. And underneath this all is the fact that the carpool lane's primary function is as a lane to increase occupancy in vehicles. So in those vehicles that have more than one occupant in it are the ones that get the prime benefit of that lane. And then anything else fits into that area of excess capacity. And using that excess capacity, one of the possible things that has been used is incentives like this, where
And what is – I'm just – it makes me curious about what percentage of people using those lanes are people who actually really are carpooling versus people who have had the little yellow decal.
You know, that varies different parts of the state. You know, the Air Board is not the agency that monitors the actual flow rates in the carpool lanes. Our concern is that when Caltrans and other authorities determine that there is excess capacity, we determine which vehicles are the good fit for utilizing that excess capacity.
And let's talk more about that good fit now and the next generation of alternatively powered vehicles. Joining us to add into our conversation this morning are Mike Omotoso. He's the Senior Manager of Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Forecasting for J.D. Power & Associates, which is an independent market research firm. Mike Omotoso, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Mark Duvall joins us as well. He is the Director of Electric Transportation for the Electric Power Research Institute, which is a nonprofit center for public interest, energy, and environmental research. Mark Duvall, thanks for joining us as well.
Oh, good morning.
So let's talk about what comes next, if that's fair to say, not to make the hybrid passé necessarily. But, well, let's start with that, Mike Omotoso. Is the hybrid now passé? Is it really time to focus on something that is the next generation?
No, I don't think the hybrid is passé, but hybrids have been on sale since in the U.S. since 1999. So hybrids are well established in the market. We're moving on to the next generation of alternative fuel vehicles, which are plug-in hybrids. That are vehicles that can go anything from 10 to 15 miles on to 50 miles on electric power only, and then another 300 miles or so with a gasoline engine. And then the other clean vehicle is the pure electric vehicle, such as the Nissan Leaf, that doesn't have an engine and only has a battery and runs on electricity only. So we think there'll be a combination of hybrids, plug-ins, and battery electric vehicles on the roads going forward.
And how many of those are out there in terms of, let's start with a pure electric car, the Nissan Leaf, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in some detail a little bit later in the program. But describe what that car is and how many of them are actually out there right now.
Well, the Nissan Leaf is a subcompact car. It's actually based on the Nissan Versa, and it has a 100-mile all-electric range. The MSRP is about $33,000, but it qualifies for this $7,500 federal tax credit, so the net price is about $25,000. Nissan has sold just over 2,100 units of the Leaf in the first 5 months of the year. We're just getting the sales numbers for this month, and we expect them to have sold another 1,000. The other electric car that's on the market is the Tesla Roadster. That's actually been on sale since 2008, but that's a $100,000 sports car, and there's not many of those on the market right now.
Mike Omotoso, he is the forecaster for hybrid and electric vehicles for J.D. Power and Associates. Mark Duvall here, too, from the Electric Power Research Institute. Mark Duvall, one of the big questions, of course, with the pure electric cars like the Nissan Leaf are how far they can go, because they can only go up to 100 miles at the maximum, right? So the question is, how available is it for you to be able to plug in wherever you travel? Walk us through some of the limitations, I guess, of electric cars and what's being done to make repowering them more accessible.
Okay, well, first of all, the Nissan Leaf is actually right about the size of a Toyota Prius, so don't let the subcompact scare you off for those on the phone that are thinking of going down and test driving one, because it's actually a fairly good-sized car.
Mm-hmm.
But so in a year or two, there will be very substantial charging infrastructure for these vehicles, and there will be a number of different options. Today, there's not really very much out there, so for most people, buying an electric car means that they're going to understand its limitation and use it within its limitations of range, which for most people that are commuting, which is kind of one of the reasons why you want to be in the carpool lane, the vast majority of commutes are easily accomplished in both directions with the range of a car like the Nissan Leaf, or there's the Chevrolet Volt, which is a type of plug-in hybrid extended range electric vehicle. Also, it's roughly 40-mile electric range is also designed around the needs of the majority of commuters. But today, if you're driving up and down around the Bay Area and you need to charge, Your most likely destination is going to be a Nissan dealership because they've installed chargers. Or if you're friends with your Chevrolet dealer, they also have chargers, the ones that are selling the Volt. So there isn't a lot of public infrastructure. There are a lot of plans for public infrastructure. Local agencies have put a lot of money on the table to do their initial rollout of the public infrastructure. So it's changing rapidly. Today there's not a lot there, but that will change rapidly. And keep in mind that public infrastructure is for most people, it's an insurance policy. You need it there in case your plans change or you didn't get as far as you would or it's a new car and so you're a little nervous about how it works. What you'll find is that as people go through their normal day, they need it there just in case, but they don't use it, which is great because it means you don't really need, you don't really need parking lots with hundreds of charge stations and all these things. You just need an even sort of network of chargers that are reliable and accessible.
And walk us through, Mark Duval, if you would, what the charging requirements are, because one of the things that can be off-putting to people is the idea that you've got to plug in your car to charge it up and that can take as many as I understand it, 18 hours if you're just using a standard sort of AC plug-in.
Yeah, sure. So there's two types of charging from just your standard household electrical service, and we call them level one and level two. And level one is the 120 volt outlet. It's just like there's a cord set. It has kind of a little box in the middle of it, and you plug it into any normal outlet, and it charges your car at about 1400 watts, which is about the power output of a space heater. And that'll charge a Chevrolet Volt in about 8 to 10 hours fully for about 40 miles of electric range. And it'll charge probably a fully depleted Nissan Leaf in about roughly 20 to 24 hours. So it's slow, but it's reliable, and they're everywhere. So if you drive to the San Francisco airport and park in long-term parking, there's a row of plugs right by the elevator where you can plug in that cord set. And since you're going to get on an airplane, chances are by the time you get back, you'll be fully charged.
And the next option is the one that charges at a higher rate. And those charging units cost some money to acquire, right?
Well, it's called level two, and it's 240 volts. So think clothes dryer,
yeah,
or air conditioner. It's this level of appliance. And they can be fairly expensive, but the costs are coming down. Now, there are units out there, fairly simple units that are $500 or less, and expect those costs to keep coming down because the charge stations themselves are not that complicated. So keep thinking that this is a near-term issue, and you'll get both more sophisticated options with more features, internet connected, so you can manage your car remotely, or very, very simple and very, very inexpensive. And if you have a normal garage, that installation process, typically, that's around $1,000 worth of work, but we think that's also trending down because really it's about the same as wiring your garage. If you're going to put an electric dryer in your garage, you're going to wire your garage. That's about the level of work. So that's going to get less expensive as the electricians realize that, hey, I'm not looking at 8 or 16 hours of work. I'm looking at a few hours of work, and I'll be out the door. So that's also improving. And for electric vehicle owners, you're probably going to tend toward that level two option. It's faster. You could charge a Leaf in about 8 hours. You can charge the new Ford Focus Electric in about 4 hours, and you can charge a Chevrolet Volt in about 3 to 4 hours
So
that's just more flexible.
It's part of the price of what you've got to factor in if you're going to acquire one of these vehicles. But again, given the rebates that are available right now for some of these vehicles, the overall price may not be that daunting. We can get a little more of a picture now on what's involved in acquiring one of these vehicles from Christina Fregamene. She's the Leaf sales specialist for the Nissan dealership in San Leandro. Christina, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Tell us what sales have been like so far for the Nissan Leaf.
This vehicle is attracting a lot of interest. Basically, the Leaf is on a pre-order basis only right now, minus the ones that are orphan Leafs.
Orphan Leafs? What are orphan Leafs?
Well, there's been a few customers. Obviously, the customers who have ordered these vehicles, they order them approximately a year before they arrive. And so sometimes life changes for these customers, and so, maybe a loss of a job, addition of a baby, they it doesn't make sense for their life anymore by the time the car arrives. So we've had a few orders that have fallen through, but not many.
So in the main, though, this is something where you put your name on a wait list and you wait for a while, right? This isn't something where you can drive it off the lot.
No. Basically, what happens is you would go on an interest list. Nissan opens up their interest list, and you would go on their interest list, and then a few months later, you'd pay a $99 deposit. A few months later, Nissan would let you know when you're eligible to order your Leaf. So even getting on the interest list doesn't mean you've placed an order yet. Once you place your order, you're looking at a 3 to 7 month wait time before your vehicle arrives.
And what do you tell people who are anxious about the fact that the range on these cars, the Leafs, is somewhere between 75 and 100 miles, and they're worried that they're going to get somewhere, and they'll simply run out of juice?
Well, you know, it's funny because there's some customers that really do have the range anxiety, and what I would say to those customers would be, you know, they have the ability to charge to an 80% charge versus 100% charge. The 100% charge will obviously get you in that 67 to 125 is actually the top max out range. And so I would suggest that they start at least for a week on that, and then they can see if they'd like to go to an 80% charge. Basically, it's going to depend. And Nissan, actually, when they go to do the interest list, they actually have the customers take a survey. And the survey would let the customer know if the Leaf would fit into their lifestyle based on their commute and driving habits.
And do you have to? There's been some. I'm somewhat confused about whether or not it's a requirement that people buy the sort of home charging couple thousand dollars a unit operation that Mark Duvall was describing. Do you have to buy one of those in order to qualify for being able to buy a Leaf?
You can sign a waiver and go with the trickle charger. And the trickle charger is the charger that comes with the vehicle, and it gives you 100% charge in 20 hours.
And lastly, again, the price on these, the sticker price is, what, $32,000? But then factor in all the rebates, what actually someone who's interested in going down and getting these would actually wind up paying?
Well, the rebates just changed a bit. So basically, California had a $5,000 rebate and federal had a $7,500 tax credit. The $7,500 tax credit is still in effect. The $5,000 California rebate has run out. However, California did get the budget. They were budgeted for the 2012 for basically more money, which would give the customers. They want to give the customers more customers a rebate, so they've reduced the rebate to $2,500.
And so the bottom line price?
You can get into one of these Leafs for probably around 23 plus tax and license. That's a SV model where most of the customers are going with the SL.
Christina Fregamani, she is the Leaf sales specialist for the San Leandro Nissan dealership. Christina, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we're going to open up our phone lines at this point, too. If you have a question about electric cars, we haven't yet talked about hydrogen fuel cell cars. We want to get into that as well and the kinds of stickers that you'll get if you buy one of those cars and what this will mean for the Bay Area commute. You can join us. Join us, too, if you're a Prius driver and wondering what to do next. 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. John Swanton, let's do a bit of review at this point in terms of the kinds of stickers that are now available. The yellow stickers, no more, right? Those were for those 85,000 hybrid drivers. Now we have white stickers for the electric cars that we've just been talking about, with green stickers still to come. Tell us briefly the definition of green and white, if you would.
Well, the white sticker was the original sticker adopted back in 99, and that is for electric vehicles, 100% electric, and super clean alternative fuel, which really works out to a small group of natural gas-powered vehicles. The second sticker program to come along was the yellow sticker program. That was the largest group of vehicles, and that one, the requirements on that were that you have an advanced technology hybrid, one that had certain amounts of power provided by the hybrid system, and a fuel-efficient vehicle as well. Now what's happening is the next generation of hybrids with the green sticker, and that will be available starting January 1 of next year. And what that requires is that the vehicle be an enhanced type of hybrid or a plug-in hybrid in which it has at least a 10-mile range on all-electric power. So we have vehicles like the Prius that have now been released for a demonstration program that qualify for that green sticker once it's available, and it's expected that about the time that sticker would be available, Toyota would start delivering those types of vehicles. And General Motors is working very hard to make sure that the Chevy Volt would also qualify for that as well. So right now, when the program will start at the beginning of the year, probably a couple of choices for consumers on those types of stickers. The white sticker program, a lot of people tend to forget about it, but it's chugging along. And as Mike said, there are sales that are increasing with the Nissan. We are over 13,000 white stickers in California right now, and that number is going to continue to increase.
And those go on forever, right?
There's a limit. They expire the first of 2015 as well.
Okay.
But there is no limit to the total number
I see.
Of those.
Okay. And the green, which are the sort of intermediate step, these are for the new plug-in hybrids or like the Chevy Volt if they qualify, those would also be time limited?
Those are time limited, and they're limited to 40,000 as well.
So we've got white and green, yellow, no more. Again, if you'd like to join us and have questions for any of our guests, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Forum at kqed.org is the email address, forum at kqed.org. We'll start taking your calls in just a moment. They're all lined up, and we'll take our first. Let's hear next from Stacy in Sunnyvale. Stacy, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've been driving a Honda Civic Hybrid for 5 years. I bought it purely to get in the carpool lane, and I'm just devastated that I can't drive there anymore. And I can't even buy a car that I can get in the carpool lane with. And it seems like they ended the program before they gave people the ability to, you know, replace it with something else. And
right.
I just feel like I'm caught in a crunch.
Stacy, thanks. John Swanton, you want to respond, please?
Yeah, the legislature had to look at its best information that it had as to when it actually phased the program out. The expiration date today is an extension of the program. The legislature extended it one last time last September, and based on the information that they had then and the delivery rates of other vehicles and federal law as well, they had to pick a time that they started phasing this part of the program out. So on that, consumers were notified when the vehicles were sold. They've been notified a number of times by mail from the DMV that it was going to end. It's not something that we are real happy about, because these folks did make those vehicles a success in the beginning. But the program did start out as a temporary program, and even with the advanced vehicles that are going to be getting it in the future, it's still a temporary program.
And would part of the answer also be, and I'll have to ask you to keep your answer quite short because we're about to go to a break, that if you didn't make this change, then there wouldn't be any incentive for people to go to the next generation?
Correct.
John Swanton joining us, along with Mike Amatoso of J.D. Power & Associates and Mark Duvall of the Electric Power Research Institute. When we come back, we're also going to hear from the very first owner of a Chevrolet Volt in the Bay Area. That'll be coming up as well. And we'll take all your calls about the future of alternative vehicles in the Bay Area. What are you drawn to at this point? Do electric cars make sense for your family? What questions do you have about them? And if you're like Stacy, what are you going to do now? If you have already purchased a hybrid vehicle like the Prius, what are you going to do now that that yellow decal doesn't work anymore? 866-733-6786. Email us at forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your questions there. We'll be back in just a moment with all those questions and hopefully some answers. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the end of the carpool lane access for drivers of, I guess you'd call them at this point, traditional hybrid cars, and what the future now may mean for both those cars, but also, of course, for new alternatively powered cars. The electric car, we'll get into the fuel cell, hydrogen fuel cell cars as well. John Swanton joins us of the California Air Resources Board, along with Mike Omotoso of J.D. Power & Associates and Mark Duvall, Director of Electric Transportation for the Electric Power Research Institute. Your calls and emails, lots of calls and questions to get into, so let's get right to that. An email first. John Swanton, maybe you can take this one. This person writes in, I saw a California Highway Patrol car on the Bay Bridge this morning pulling over a Prius. Is this the first day of carpool enforcement? What? No grace period?
Well, Highway Patrol has indicated that they would enforce from day one on this. Owners did receive a letter a few months ago explaining that the program was coming to a conclusion and that citations could happen from the first day. So at this point right now, Highway Patrol's policy is that they would enforce starting today.
Mike Omotoso, a couple of emails on costs. What's the daily cost of electricity to charge an electric car?
Well, electricity costs nationwide about 10 cents per kilowatt hour, and Nissan Leaf has a 24 kilowatt hour battery, so that would be $2.40 to fully charge it. Chevy Volt has a 16 kilowatt hour battery, so that's $1.60. So that's $1.60 per day for your daily commute versus $4 a gallon for gas.
So you can really think of that as you're filling up your car for a couple of bucks?
Yeah, definitely.
And here's the flip side of that question that this emailer also writes in, and Mark Duvall, to you please on this. What's the environmental impact, though, of producing that electricity? So as someone who's concerned about overall environmental consequence, are we doing something good on the one hand and not so good on the other?
Well, we studied this extensively, and I spent a couple years of my life trying to answer this question because it was actually a really popular question a couple years ago when we were just talking about electric vehicles. And the end result is that if you look how the electric system operates, at we call it a smokestack by smokestack level, and then you look at where all the tailpipe emissions are reduced because you're not burning gasoline, even out of the cleanest vehicles like a Toyota Prius or some of the other very clean vehicles. The net effect is very much overwhelmingly positive everywhere in the United States, even where you get your electricity from older fossil fuel plants that might not have the latest controls. That simply, if you look at the electric sector, it's highly regulated. Those regulations are strict and also increasing over time. Every year there's new regulations to comply with. And look at the plants that are available to charge the vehicle to generate the electricity. The net effect is you have both lower carbon dioxide emissions, so fewer climate change gases, and fewer criteria emissions, so cleaner air, and especially where people drive. So that means dense urban areas where there's a lot of traffic.
So no question that it's the greener choice. Let's go to another question about the costs of maintaining an electric car. Murali joins us in San Jose. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Great topic. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, my question was about the service costs for maintenance of an electric vehicle, whether it's significantly higher because there aren't going to be many mechanics around, right, being able to service. I'll take my comments off here.
Okay, thanks. Mark Duvall or Mike, either one, can you take that question,
yeah,
please?
I'd be happy to do that. First of all, you need to separate it into maintenance and repair. So in terms of maintenance, you maintain an electric car or a plug-in hybrid, like any other normal car, you have oil changes in the Volt. They're just typically very, very far apart because you're not using the engine very much. You're mostly running on electricity. And the vehicle's battery system is relatively maintenance-free. Electric motors, these things have very, very low maintenance. So, you know, there will always be idiosyncrasies in this system, but in general it should cost no more and could potentially cost less to maintain an electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid. Now, repair is a different story. If you have things start to fail out of warranty, then that can get pretty expensive. And, you know, we've all had a automatic transmission fail before. You know, we felt the car was, you know, ready to get rid of, and that's very expensive. And I think what we've seen with hybrids, which have many of the same types of components as plug-in hybrids and electric vehicles, they can be very reliable. So reliability to me, so the frequency of repair is mostly dependent on how good the car is. And cars today are really very, very good. If you look at J.D. Power's results, they show that, you know, the best and the worst keep getting closer and closer together in their long-term reliability studies. So the future is pretty bright in the area. I wouldn't worry too much about maintenance and repair at all, even a brand new vehicle.
Let's hear, actually, from a Chevrolet Volt owner. Patrick Wang, in fact, was the very first person to buy a Chevrolet Volt in the Bay Area. Patrick, thank you for joining in on our conversation today.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you. Tell us about your experience so far in terms of particularly this question about costs that we've been talking about. Are you happy with your Volt so far? Have there been any unforeseen consequences, financial consequences, I guess, to owning one?
Actually, I'm very happy with the car right now. I got my car in December pretty much on release date, and I did run into a few minor issues, but all of them were resolved under warranty, and none of them were critical. So some of the things I'm talking about are, you know, there's a couple bulbs that were burned out in the taillight, and little things like that, that it wasn't that difficult to bring it back in dealer and have it repaired. But other than that, fantastic experience, and they've been pretty much on top of making sure that the initial release has gone well, you know, as well as a brand new high-technology vehicle can go.
Now, we were talking with someone who represents a Nissan Leaf before the break. They're the sort of pure electric car, and they're both pluses and obviously some limitations to those. Your car, the Chevrolet Volt, is a combination. You can go on electric for a limited number of miles, up to 40, but then you have the advantage of being able to drive as far as you want because there's also the gasoline engine. Was that compromise important to you so that you could sort of swing both ways?
Well, I guess you could call it a compromise, but I kind of call it a feature. It actually was an absolutely critical feature for me. And the reason is I do make weekend jaunts over 120 miles. And as you know, the Leaf's range on a good day is about 100 miles, and I think the EPA rated it at about 75. So it just, you know, was outside of my consideration set for that. And living in Berkeley, I don't really have space for two vehicles. And, you know, we can go on the list of other reasons why I prefer the Volt. But I think that answers your question there, right?
And cost, last, if you would, Patrick, what did it cost you to get behind the wheel of a Volt?
So if you take all California taxes, all the rebates, all that sort of stuff, out the door, it was about $42,000. I got it fully loaded, so that was, $45,000 plus California tax minus the federal rebates. And obviously, there's some really nice incentives early in the release to get plug-in technology, level 2 charging at home. So that was great.
All right. Patrick, thank you. Thanks for adding your perspective to our conversation this morning. And back to the rest of our calls. Let's go next to Arthur in Palo Alto. Arthur, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for covering this topic. I've been driving electric since 2001. I now have two Toyota RAV4 EVs, and earlier this month I picked up a Nissan Leaf, and I'm very happy with it. I don't have any gas cars, and I have overcome my range anxiety, and if I really need to go far, I rent the car when the rare times that I do that. I'm actually driving next week to Stinson Beach, and I'm going to charge up there while I stay up for a few days and then come back in my Nissan Leaf.
All right, Arthur, thank you. Thanks for adding your experience into our conversation. It sounds like you're a man of no regret in terms of going all electric all the time.
I'm a man of no regret. I'm also powering my electric cars with City of Palo Alto has a green power program. And it's a great mixture, which is to mix it with photovoltaics that I'm putting on this summer. And photovoltaics will allow me to put power on the grid during the day and take the power off of the grid at night to power my cars. And I'm thinking of the grid as a giant battery for my photovoltaic system.
All right, Arthur, thank you. Emails coming in. Here's someone who says, the hybrid program, the yellow sticker program, never made any sense. Hybrid cars shut off their gas engine when sitting in traffic and emit no emissions. Let them sit in traffic and give the gas hogs and emitters quick passage. Jim writes in, is it possible to have battery swap stations similar to gasoline filling stations? I can see difficulties around the quality of swap-ins versus swap-out battery packs and the design of the vehicle. But the overall overwhelming benefit is eliminating vehicle downtime for charging. To tell you the truth, I'm not sure I fully understand the question. So, Mark Duvall, if you do, please answer.
Sure. There's a startup company in, actually, I think, I don't know if they're headquartered in Palo Alto, but they certainly have a big office in Palo Alto called Better Place. And their technology concept is to build electric vehicles with more or less a uniform or a small number of fairly uniform batteries that can then just sort of disconnect from the vehicle, both physically, because you're dealing with several hundred pounds, and electrically, and then switch another one in very quickly in the 5 minutes it would take you to go to a gas station. And they have some full on programs in Israel and Denmark to show this very thing. I think they have a small pilot in the Bay Area that they have some public funding to do. I think it's primarily for taxis. And it's a very interesting concept because it does erase that range limitation. Mm-hmm. However, you know, capitally intensive infrastructure is challenging. And I think we'll wait to see. You know, they're going to do this in Israel and Denmark, and they've got a pilot program in the U.S., and we'll see what happens. If it takes off and the automakers decide that they're going to want to design this technology into their vehicles, it can certainly be successful. And to me, that's always the stumbling block. I do research on behalf of the electric utility industries, and we've always understood that we can't make electric vehicles. The auto industry has to make them. And so we really have to look at what they intend to do and help support them as the energy provider as much as possible.
Let's spend a moment on some of the other alternatives besides electric. We haven't talked yet about hydrogen fuel cell possibilities, Mike Omotoso. There's someone who's writing in about compressed natural gas. Those are being demonstrated right now by UPS and U.S. Mail. Walk us through those options. Why don't you tell us the latest, if you would, on hydrogen fuel cells, because they have some potential pluses that the electric cars don't have either, right?
Yes, hydrogen fuel cells do have potential, and we've seen some manufacturers experiment with fuel cell vehicles. GM, for example, has a fuel cell version of the Chevrolet Equinox that they've been demonstrating for the past few years. Honda has the FCX Clarity, which is available for limited lease in California. But there are a few problems. One is the vehicles are very expensive, hundreds of thousands of dollars, in fact. Yeah. Another problem is infrastructure. They're less than 100 hydrogen filling stations across the country, and about half of them are in California. But the infrastructure definitely needs to be built up, and it will cost billions of dollars to build up that infrastructure. And there's also a chicken and egg situation. Do you build the fuel cell cars first and then the infrastructure follows, or build the infrastructure first, and that will encourage car makers to build hydrogen fuel cell vehicles?
So it doesn't sound like that's an alternative that's going to be at least affordable any time soon, given both the price point you're talking about and the infrastructure problems. What about what's called compressed natural gas? Is that any closer to being a practical reality?
Compressed natural gas, or CNG, is definitely a reality, especially in fleets, in commercial fleets such as UPS, as you mentioned, and also with heavy trucks. But we don't see significant potential in the retail market for the average consumer. Honda has a natural gas version of the Civic that they've been selling for a few years, but the natural gas Civic is actually more expensive than the hybrid Civic, and Honda only sells 1,000 to 2,000 units of the natural gas version per year. Ford tried selling some natural gas versions of the Crown Victoria and the Taurus about 10 years ago, but it wasn't really well received.
And John Swanton, back at the California Air Resources Board, is the state sort of agnostic about future alternatives so long as they're sort of zero emission? Doesn't really matter whether they're electric or compressed natural gas or someday hydrogen fuel cells?
Correct. We try and look at the outcomes rather than the particular fuel to get there. We do help out, though, with trying to make sure that we participate in infrastructure issues. I mean, we've funded infrastructure for the future for hydrogen. We've funded some for natural gas. So we try and interact where it's appropriate for those particular areas. But really, we want the marketplace and the competition between manufacturers to drive these technologies.
And back to our calls. Leslie in Oakland is up next. Leslie, go ahead, please.
Hi, I wanted to know if I was considering putting on a solar roof, what sort of extra capacity should I consider for if I want to buy an electric car in the future, which I think I do.
Oh, interesting question. Mark Duvall?
Well, how long is your commute? What does your typical driving day look like?
An hour each way. An hour each way.
So about maybe 80 miles?
Yeah.
Okay, and are you Dale Earnhardt Jr. or my grandmother in your driving style?
In between.
Okay. You probably need about, let's just say a round number, you probably need about 20 kilowatt hours a day. So assuming you bought an electric vehicle and did that, first of all, you probably want to get your employer to put in a charger at work, because if you have workplace charging, your commute is really very easy to do in a Nissan Leaf or a similar electric vehicle. If you are trying to do it one way, you may live without air conditioning and heat on some of those days. But so in general, you need about 20 kilowatt hours per day. So probably about 4,000 to 5,000 kilowatt hours a year. So your solar provider can tell you how much extra capacity it'll take to generate that much energy. You're, by the way, you're sort of on the upper end of commuters. You commute a very long distance. You may not be able to make that up with added solar capacity, at least cost effectively. So it's important to remember that electric vehicles and solar panels are like vitamins and vegetables. Both are good. You shouldn't think that you have to take both or none, you know. So, I mean, if you can buy an electric vehicle and increase your solar panel and you choose to do that, that's great. But electric vehicle is a great consumer choice. California has an extremely clean electric grid. Your energy is going to come basically from wind and very, very clean natural gas power plants. So, I mean, even if you can't get it done with solar, you should still feel like you should go do it, because displacing all that gasoline you've been using will be highly beneficial. And I would also point out that an electric car in your commute would be about the cheapest thing you could do for any comparable, new car, including a Prius or any hybrid. It would be a good economic decision today at today's prices.
Leslie, thanks for the call. Let's go right to Steve next in San Mateo. Steve, you're on.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So I commute from San Mateo to San Jose every day, about 56 miles round trip. I bought a Prius used with stickers 3 years ago, and of course I paid a premium to buy it, and I have enjoyed, using it all this time. But I knew that the end was coming, so I ordered a Leaf, and I took delivery on it about a month ago. I'm waiting now, not so patiently, for my decals to arrive. DMV is, a little slow these days. It's a great car, rides really well. It's amazing, actually. It takes off like a rabbit when you need it to. It's very quiet, obviously. A key point, though, and my area that has been, somewhat of a concern is, when they talk about the cost to operate the Leaf at 10 cents a kilowatt hour, I'm at the top tier of PG&E's rate structure, so I'm paying more like 37 cents a kilowatt hour. So,
oh, because of the upper tier or however that's calculated? Yep.
Right. So you have a couple of choices. I've just got a quote from an electrician to put in a separate panel and a separate meter. That's going to cost me about $2,500. So I've done the math, and that's maybe about a 1.5 to 2 year, payback. The other alternative is you can switch rate plans and do a timed rate plan, but it's a bit of a catch-22 mm-hmm. that you get a higher rate, for your normal usage, and then you get the lower rate when you schedule the car to charge, overnight. And like your previous caller, I'm also just getting ready to get a quote on putting solar on the house, but just wanted to get your thoughts about, where that's all heading.
Steve, thanks. Thanks for the call. Mike Amatoso, let's go to you on that, and sort of maybe any other caveats that people who right now have electric car fever ought to think about before they make this investment, because it sounds like from Steve's call there's some spin-off costs and that you have to consider as well.
There are definitely some spin-off costs. You have to decide whether it's worth spending about $2,500 to get a 240-volt charging station installed in your house. You have to look at the dual cost-benefit analysis, basically. Is it worth paying, say, an extra $10,000 for your vehicle if you're only going to keep a vehicle for 2 or 3 years. The payback period might be 5, 6, or 7 years compared to what you would spend on a cheaper car running on gasoline. And now that you can't use the HOV lanes anymore, you have to figure how much time is that going to add to my commute? Is it worth buying a alternative fuel vehicle to save the environment, but it's going to cost me a lot of money out of pocket? And some people do buy vehicles for the image, regardless of the financial considerations. And how long is your commute? Do you take many out-of-town trips? Are you going to drive from San Francisco to L.A. on a regular basis, or go to wine country? There are several factors to consider, and there isn't one single solution that fits every consumer. Every consumer has a different profile.
Yeah, it sounds like the kind of purchase where you really have to kind of go through a laundry list of questions about all of the things that are important to you and your particular lifestyle and commute pattern and price and all the rest before you make this kind of choice. John Swanton, here's a question for you. Marge writes in, I own a clean diesel, and I've been annoyed that hybrids get special treatment while clean diesel cars do not. I get 38 miles per hour around town, 45 on the highway. Clean diesel does not have the battery issues that hybrids have. Can you explain why clean diesel is not promoted more?
Well, one of the problems with clean diesel is that while the diesel vehicles that are produced now are extremely clean to those of just a few years ago, they still are worse than the average vehicle in many cases on the roads for California. Diesel has a number of emissions that contribute significantly to California's air pollution problem, and manufacturers have done a great job of reducing those pollutants, but they've really brought it into where it's just comparable or a little slightly worse than the average gasoline vehicle in the world. So in that, it's not clean enough to be one of these vehicles that would get the sort of incentive for carpool lane access.
All right, makes sense. Let's go next to Chris in Sacramento. Chris, you're on.
Yes, what about alcohol? Nobody's talking about alcohol. Any car that has fuel injection, you can put 50% in alcohol into your gas tank. No conversion needed. And nobody's really bringing up the alcohol. And not only that, but according to the law, people can make up to 5,000 gallons of their own alcohol without a license or a permit.
All right, Chris, don't know. Mike Omotoso, can you take that one?
Well, I guess I would use ethanol or E85 as the analogy. We've had flex fuel, also known as flex fuel, so that's 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. There are millions of flex fuel vehicles on the roads, but infrastructure again is the problem. There are only about 2,500 ethanol filling stations across the country, compared to about 160,000 gas stations. And we've seen that another issue was that the fuel economy that you get with ethanol is lower than the fuel economy with gasoline.
There are a couple of people who want to find out about natural gas again. We touched briefly on hydrogen fuel cells and natural gas, but here's Nancy who writes in, natural gas vehicles are an alternative to the electric vehicles. Natural gas vehicles are zero emission, so they can have the white stickers. For instance, the Honda Civic has a natural gas vehicle that has good mileage and is significantly cheaper, and there were federal incentives at the time I purchased it. Not sure if they're still there. Mark Duval, can you kind of give us a comparison at this point between the advisability of natural gas versus electric?
Yeah, well, I think natural gas vehicles are pretty neat, and they do have some advantages. They're very similar to a gasoline vehicle. The engine is the same. The fueling system's a little different. And obviously, instead of a gas tank holding a liquid fuel, you have these pressurized tanks holding a natural gas. However, they got into this sort of white sticker primarily because they're an alternative fuel to petroleum. And remember, at the federal level, we're trying to decouple the U.S. from the world petroleum market. And so you can – things like better fuel economy help, but fuels that aren't tied to the price of oil are best, electricity, hydrogen, maybe natural gas for the near future. Whereas things like ethanol, to answer the previous caller, they sort of hover around the price of gasoline, so they're kind of drop-in replacements. And so natural gas does have some advantages. The cars aren't zero-emitting, and And I would say that the emissions benefit between a natural gas vehicle, they have a little bit lower CO2 emissions, and they might have a little lower criteria emissions from the average, but the cleanest gasoline vehicles, are like the Prius, are really very, very clean. So okay. They don't have as much of an advantage as you would think. And in fact, natural gas, through a modern natural gas power plant, charging an electric vehicle is more efficient and has lower emissions than putting that natural gas into a conventional vehicle.
Let's go to another question about electric rates. We heard a caller earlier say that because of the amount of electricity he uses, he gets charged at the higher rate. Had a couple of other emails wondering about that as well, as does Max in San Francisco. Max, go ahead.
My name is Max Bowmaster. I work for the Natural Resources Defense Council on Electric Vehicle Integration. And speaking to the question about PG&E rates in particular, PG&E is in the process of revising their electric vehicle rates. They're already working on it, and they'll be ordered to do so by the Public Utilities Commission in a couple weeks. So I would encourage your caller to potentially wait until the new electric vehicle rates are made available to him. Which will remove the electric vehicle load from the subject of those.
Oh, that's really – thank you for calling in, Max. That's really an important factor here, because that seemed like one of the things you had to be wary of if you were going to be plugging in, that you'd be really bumping up your electricity bill if you were on that higher tier. But those rates are changing. And when will that take place, Max?
PG&E is currently working on them. They'll be ordered to complete that in a time frame that the Public Utilities Commission – I think is yet to determine, but it should be they should be in the next several months, is my understanding.
Okay.
They already have electric vehicle specific rates in all of the investor owned utility territories across California, but they're updating those, and so that dilemma should be removed.
Okay, Max, thanks. Thanks for adding that in. We're out of time, unfortunately. A couple of people had questions about batteries. And so just very briefly, Mark Duvall, can you just list a website for me, or if people are concerned about the whole battery replacement issue, where they'd go to find out more environmental information?
Probably goelectricdrive.com is probably the best site, or maybe hybridcars.com. It's not something I would encourage people to worry about. An issue with hybrids, shouldn't be an issue with electric vehicles, which have very long battery warranties, by the way.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. Mark Duvall joined us from the Electric Power Research Institute, Mike Amatoso from J.D. Power and Associates, and John Swanton, an air pollution specialist with the California Air Resources Board. Thanks all for joining our program today. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.